or call upon brother David to deliver that address then. Jephthah's daughter, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth, brother David.
My beloved brethren and sisters in the hope of Israel. Our study this evening, as has been announced, is Jephthah's daughter. And I have to say, some of you may be quite disappointed to understand that I'm not really going to spend the next 45 minutes analysing whether or not Jephthah's daughter was offered literally or symbolically. I couldn't exactly prepare an address and not look at it at all, but I'm not going to spend a particularly long time on that subject. Because Jephthah is an extremely interesting character. He is often presented, perhaps in our minds more than in any writings, but as an example of a faithful servant of God, but someone who at the same time was hasty with his words. And sort of take an example from Jephthah that we shouldn't be hasty with our words and or our vows, if you like. And while that's true, that there is an example to be learned from the life of Jephthah, I think if I can drive home one thing this evening, and I think it should be that Jephthah should be better for remembered for what is recorded of him in his faith and his courage and his valour in the service of the truth, than for the hasty vow which caused him so much problems. Of course, there's a lot of contention that surrounded Jephthah due to the fact that it doesn't seem to be clear whether he offered his daughter literally or not. But we'll look at that a little later. In Brother Brian's address on Samson, he turned to Hebrews 11, so we're not going to turn there. But Paul said, time fails me to tell of men like David, Jephthah, Gideon. And I think I made the comment either yesterday or the day before in the readings that Hebrews 11 is not just a catalogue of faithful people. These were exemplary characters, far greater than you or I will ever be. That's not to say that we aren't going to be accepted. But as we know, there are people with different talents, and I think all the people mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 are your 10 talent servants. Jephthah is a giant of faith. Let's just turn to 1 Samuel chapter 12, where he is mentioned there. This, of course, is Samuel delineating some of Israel's history and the sad lack of fidelity, rather, to God, and how they respond, how he responds to their desire for a king. Verse 11: Yahweh sent Jephthah and Bedan, and Jephthah and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelled safe. So here, even Samuel, obviously inspired, gives him a glowing report, which is echoed in Hebrews chapter 11. So let's turn now then to Judges chapter 11, which is the first of the chapters that deals with the life of Jephthah, where we read in verse 1, Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valour, and he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. He was a mighty man of valour. He was not an impetuous character, as we might think, as perhaps the later part of the record might suggest, because he said, whatever comes out of my house after I've gained a victory, I'll offer. That might seem like an impetuous kind of character. That wasn't Jephthah. Valor, interestingly, Brother Dale brought this out in his address from about David yesterday in Psalm 18, referring to strength, and he said the word strength in the Hebrew is chayil. C-H-A-Y-I-L. Valor is that same word, chayil, which is from the root word chil, a root meaning to twist or to turn. Strange how that makes its way into the English word as strength or valor. The root word does have many applications, But in its derivation for chayil, which is the word for valor or strength, I think various, like Jesenius, Strong, suggest that it's a strength that comes from twisting. And perhaps we can understand that if we understand that twisting fibers creates a strong, flexible rope. I think that's kind of the message they're trying to deliver, and that's the character that we have. He is a valiant man, not just stupidly brave, as some people in the world have been. This was an intelligent valor. This was a valor based on the knowledge and the faith that God can deliver. And you see that the word men of valor, or valor, is also used to describe David's mighty men. And of course, we know that David's mighty men are typical of Christ's immortal mighty ones, who will be used to subdue all the nations, who will go forth to execute the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. And as we go through, we'll see some other similarities between David's mighty men and David and Jephthah. Mighty, the mighty man of valor. Mighty, we know, is Gibor. For example, that's often used, El Gibor, God Almighty. It simply means mighty, all-powerful. It's also used in Genesis 47, verse 6. There are a couple of references, but we're really up against it time-wise, so I'm only going to turn to this one. Genesis chapter 47. The land of, Genesis 47, verse 6. Joseph is obviously presenting his father to Pharaoh, the ruler. The land of Egypt, verse 6, is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. That word activity is the same word, Gibor. And if you look at Exodus 18, verse 21, they describe able men. That word able is Gibor. So you can see that it's not just mighty in the sense of the world might use mighty. Russia is mighty. That's not the kind of might that's being driven home here. It also denotes virtue and integrity. It's not just pure might. It's might with the characteristics that make men pleasing to God, virtuous and faithful men. This is the man Jephthah that we're talking about. Verse 1 is the first mention we have of Jephthah, and this is a glowing report. If this could be said about me in my life, just what is said in verse 1, I would be a happy man. And Jephthah, of course, is a wonderful type of Christ, which you probably would have noticed in the when Brother Stephen read the chapter to introduce our remarks. The context of the life of Jephthah is a very sad one, however. The context is purely and simply the sin of Israel. Without the sin of Israel, there would be no Jephthah, not at least as a judge and a deliverer. It's a very sad and melancholy cycle that we read of in Judges, almost from Judges chapter 1 to the last chapter. Let's turn quickly to Judges chapter 2, where this cycle is sort of introduced. Judges chapter 2 and verse 8. Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of Yahweh, died being 110 years old. The pioneers of Israel had died. They buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the mount of Ephraim, on the north side of the hill Gaash. And all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them which knew not Yahweh, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Could I go any further without drawing the comparison between the death of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts? The generation of them, within the days of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts, generally appreciated their works. But unfortunately, generations rose after them that knew them not. They weren't fully acquainted with the works of Brother Thomas. They didn't make the writings of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts paramount in their lives, second, of course, to the daily readings. What happened? verse 11. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh and served Baalim, and they forsook Yahweh, their Elohim of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked Yahweh to anger. And they forsook Yahweh, and they served Baal and Asherah. So there's the first part of the cycle. The sin of Israel. What does sin bring? Well, of course, sin brings death. But in a national sense, the anger of Yahweh, verse 14, was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoiled them, etc. However, God is long-suffering and merciful. Verse 16, nevertheless, Yahweh raised up judges which delivered them out of the hand of those that spoiled them. It doesn't mention it here, but as you go through the record, you will find that it was seeking God which brought this raising up of judges to deliver them. It wasn't just an automatic thing that God decided, okay, they've had enough, now we'll deliver them. It was a seeking God which brought salvation. So here's our cycle then. Sin brought suffering, and seeking God brought salvation. And to the context of Jephthah's life is another one of these cycles. This pattern of rebellion, suffering, repentance, and delivering or salvation continued right up to the days of Jephthah. In fact, over a 450-year period, Israel repetitively apostatized from the truth. The context of the life of Jephthah is a serving of the gods of Ammon. Chapter 10 and verse 6. The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh, and served Baalim and Ashtaroth, and the gods of Syria, and the gods of Zidon, and the gods of Moab, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and forsook Yahweh and served him not. And they were delivered into the children of Ammon. Verse 16, they turned to Yahweh. They put away the strange gods from among them and served Yahweh, and his soul was grieved with the misery of Israel. And there's two things to bear in mind here. They apostatized from the truth and turned unto other gods, the gods of the children of Ammon. It was the gods, Ammon, that actually became the masters over Israel. They were the ones that were sent to judge Israel. And the second thing to remember here is verse 16, they put away the strange gods from among them. There's to be no deliverance or salvation for us if we don't put away all that offends in our lives. There was to be no salvation for Israel had they not put away the strange gods from among them. So let's go back to Jephthah then, chapter 11. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and they thrust out Jephthah, and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren, and dwelt in the land of Tob. And they were gathered vain men to Jephthah, and went out with him. He fled east then into the wilderness to escape the wrath of his brethren. Which is interesting, because we know that Moses also fled east into the wilderness after his brethren had rejected him. Moses was sent to be a judge or a deliverer, and so was Jephthah, and so was Christ. All three were rejected by their brethren. So you have some interesting similarities between, of course, Moses and Jephthah being superlative examples of faith, and Christ being the perfect example of faith and deliverance. Verse 4, it came to pass in process of time that the children of Ammon made war against Israel. And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, Come and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. Why on earth, we ask, well, we might ask, did they seek after Jephthah? Well, why not somebody else? This was someone, remember, that they hated. Perhaps verse 1 gives us the clue. Mighty man of valor. Perhaps this strikes at the root of the problem. It certainly defines the problem as far as Christ was concerned. When his brethren were servants of sin, maybe, we might suggest, they envied this man of valor and integrity. The fact that he was the son of a harlot may have merely aggravated their detestation of him. That was the same with Christ. They say, we be not born of sin. They thought that Christ, being born of a virgin, they sort of attributed this same sort of stigma to Christ. Another comparison between Jephthah and Christ. So maybe the fact that he was a mighty man of valor was exactly the problem initially. And when they realized that they were really suffering under the hand of Ammon and wanted deliverance from it, they humbled themselves and recognized, this is the man who can deliver us. They now appreciated what the kind of man that was required. You can bet that there would have been people who would have been tough, who would have been strong, able to carry spears and swords and you name it. But perhaps by now they'd realized that it wasn't just a man strong in the flesh that they required, it was a man strong in spiritual things. This kind of process is not unusual in things concerning God's ways. For example, Brother Thomas and Brother Robert. Brother Thomas recognized in Brother Robert the man that was necessary to carry on the work of, if you like, leading the truth in the publication of the Christadelphian magazine. Brother Thomas had ended the work of the Herald due to the American Civil War, and recognized that they did need some sort of way of communicating to all the brethren and providing material for study and so forth. And despite his young age, Brother Thomas recognized that Brother Roberts was the character for it. We read in verse 3, excuse me, they were gathered vain men to Jephthah and went out with him. Some translators or the other translations say worthless men were gathered to Jephthah and went out with him, which is entirely different to vanity in Ecclesiastes. So you have the vain men here, that is an entirely different root word to the vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, all is vanity that we read of in Ecclesiastes. The word in Ecclesiastes is hebel and means emptiness or transitoriness. Perfect word for what Solomon was trying to drive home. But that's not the word that is used here. This same word is used in Judges 9 verse 4. They gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, wherewith Abimelech hired vain and light persons which followed him. So we might automatically conclude then that Jephthah associated himself with a horrid class of people. But the Companion Bible renders it unemployed or bankrupt men. Jesenius renders it impoverished or poor. And I believe, in fact I'm firmly convicted, that this is closer to the reality. They weren't necessarily vain men as such. They certainly weren't worthless in one sense, but they were unemployed, bankrupt, impoverished or poor. Hebrews 11 verse 24, regarding Moses, Paul says, he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Laying account with Israel in the days of Moses was akin to making friends with the inhabitants of council estates, or as you may call them in the US, trailer parks. He wasn't making friends with Israel, who were a great and mighty nation. They were despised serfs. And that's who Moses decided to throw in his lot with. Not with the glories of Egypt, not with the gold and jewels of this life, but with God's people. And Jephthah, likewise, had no option but to join with these people. They weren't men of no worth, we believe. This does not justify friendship with the world, with wicked people. These were worthless men in the sight of the world. They were the rejects of society. And we mentioned earlier on the comparison with David's mighty men. David's mighty men were also men of were social reject, you might say. They weren't people of high standing. They weren't people who were in the court of Saul, sort of managed the nation and helped Saul govern. These were men who had problems, who may have had debts or whatever. These were the people who associated themselves with David. And likewise, these were the men who associated themselves with Jephthah, we believe. And of course, all God's faithful servants, I emphasize faithful servants, find themselves in a wilderness of some kind. We could turn to Apocalypse 12, where we read of the fleeing of the woman from the beast and essentially Roman Catholicism. Here, Jephthah and his men were fleeing from the spiritualized apostate Israel, which is exactly the same as the servants in the days of Constantine and afterwards. They were fleeing from the apostatized spiritual Israel. We read in Apocalypse 7 the numbering of the 144,000 out of every tribe of Israel. They were the apostatized spiritual Israel that became Roman Catholicism. And the fate of the servants, we read of those who lived in dens and caves of the earth. Real truth holders have never fitted into the world. It's like trying to fit a square shape into a round hole. It doesn't work. It doesn't happen. In Genesis, we read that there would be inevitably and unequivocally war between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Never twain would meet. And this is the condition that God's misfits have found themselves in most ages. They're not vain, they're not worthless in the sight of God, but in the sight of the world they are. Of course, many professed truth holders have fitted into the world. They have been very successful individuals in their field. Like the Laodiceans, we might say. Rich and increased with goods. Sociable, very respectable people, moral people for the largest part. But worthy in the sight of the world, but in God's eyes, poor and wretched and blind and pitiable and naked. So, accepting the invite then of his brethren, he prepares for the inevitable conflict with Ammon. He knew the conflict would come. What did he do though? Verse 11, Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before Yahweh in Mizpah. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, What hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land? And the king of the children of Ammon answered unto the messenger of Jephthah, Because Israel took away my land, when they came up out of Egypt, from Arnon even unto Jabbok and unto Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands again peaceably. The first thing I'd like to say here is, there's some really interesting sort of chronological events here which show that what the king of Ammon said was a load of rubbish. But we really don't have time. It's quite involved when you have to go back and look at the chapters in Joshua, but I recommend that it's done. I haven't actually marked it in my Bible yet, but it is worth doing, because what we have here is an exact counterpart to the Palestinian problem today. This refugee problem is not a refugee problem because of Israel. It's a refugee problem because the Arabs tried to invade and throw Israel into the sea, and they failed. So it's their problem, not Israel's problem. The problem here is very similar if you look at the chapters in Joshua as the invasion of Israel took place. We can't say any more than that. But what we wish to home in on is that it was a typical unreasonable approach by the children of Ammon. Typical unreasonableness of flesh, pure and simple. Unenlightened flesh, you might say. Nevertheless, what we realize is that Jephthah took a conciliatory approach. He didn't go in all guns blazing, as you might say. He went in and said, What hast thou to do with me that thou art come against me to fight in my land? But flesh cannot be reasoned with. I had some very interesting links here, but we really, really don't have time. Unenlightened flesh is nothing more than Leviathan, and of course our minds have already gone to Job when we mention Leviathan. Leviathan is a Hebrew word generally having reference to a serpent or wreathed animal, and Jesenius renders it wreathed or twisted in folds. And our minds, thinking of twisted in folds or wreathed, might think of the tree in the garden in Eden that was the subject of the test that was put to Adam and Eve. The serpent entwined within its the branches of that tree of knowledge of good and evil became the test to Adam and Eve. It also became the perpetrator of false doctrine, and hence became an apt symbol for all who are opposed to the ways of God. Thus, of course, the beast of the sea in the Apocalypse is a very appropriate symbol to denote Roman Catholicism. And in Isaiah 27, we have reference to the destruction of that system. In that day, Yahweh, with his sword, great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. that and this is how it will be at the return of Christ. These crooked and licentious rulers, particularly of Roman Catholicism, will have no track with God's ruler established over the earth, even the Lord Jesus Christ. But the same unreasonableness that was manifested by the children of Ammon and has been manifested by all the nations of the world will be seen most powerfully in the attitude of Roman Catholicism at the time of Christ's return. There will be an offer of peace to the nations of the world, which we understand to be the Aeonian Gospel, which essentially proclaims to the earth that power and glory has come, and submit to Christ. And we know what the end will be. I have a quote from the Herald of 1851. Brother Thomas says, "The good news of God's eternal purpose has never reached their ears." He's talking about the rulers of the world. "It is as inaudible among the heavenlies," political heavenlies of course, "as it is among the heavenlies," "as it is among the dead who are in their graves." But will this always be the case? Will remediless destruction come upon them unwarned? Did God forewarn the Antediluvians by Noah, the Egyptians by Moses, the Ninevites by Jonah, and Judah and the pagan principalities and powers in the heavenlies by the apostles? And will he not also give the existing governments of the world warning and afford them scope for the acceptance of peace or war with him who claims the heavens as an inheritance? He leaves it as an open-ended question, meaning, no, they won't accept the peaceful offer. And Brother Robert, likewise, in The Ways of Providence, says, regarding Moses, "The action of Moses in this case may throw some light on the work to be done by Christ at his coming." This is when Moses sent an ambassador to the king of Moab asking to go through his land, and he refused. He continues, "We know that the work to be done is to break in pieces the nations like a potter's vessel, to grind to powder the political image seen by Daniel, to tread the winepress of Yahweh's anger. But we may imagine from these vigorous figures of speech that the process will be prompt, rough and hurried, after the manner of the tornado, without warning and without diplomacy. This would be a mistake. The first Moses illustrates the second. The scale of operations is larger because the whole earth instead of a single country is in question, but the aims and the principles of actions will be the same, for it is the same God with the same objects at work in both cases. There will be proposals to the governments of Europe and the rejection of them, which the governments will follow up with a military initiative against Christ, as in the case of Sihon against Moses. The proposals are indicated," he says, "in Psalm 2, kiss the sun lest he be angry, and Revelation 14, fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment is come. And the result in Revelation 17, these 10 kings shall make war with the Lamb." These scriptures, he continues, briefly sketch events involving time and much detail in their evolution, for a foreshadowing in which we may usefully consult the narrative of the conquest of the land of the Amorites. The discourse with the children of Ammon was likewise fruitless. We don't read it, but we can deduce from the chapter that they were prepared to take military action against Jephthah and Israel, and that's exactly what happened. Verse 29. "Then the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto Yahweh, and said, If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be Yahweh's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. So Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and Yahweh delivered them into his hands, and he smote them from Aroeri until they come to Minnith." Pause again to reflect upon the character of Jephthah. And now, as we come towards the end of the chapter, where we begin to introduce his daughter, to recognize that this was the character that influenced his daughter and influenced Israel as well. Verse 29, "The Spirit of Yahweh came upon Jephthah." We can just read over that and say, well, yes, it was God who gave him the victory. True, it was God who gave him the victory. And that's exactly the point. It indicates that the power of God was what overcame the Ammonites, but it was through Jephthah. It suggests something else. We know in Zechariah chapter 4 verse 6, Yahweh says, "Not by strength, nor by might, but by my power." The might of the flesh plays no part in God's victories, none whatsoever. God cannot work through the proud and haughty man. Isaiah chapter 66 tells us that this man will be lucky, even unto him that is humble and of a contrite spirit. This, brethren and sisters, was the man Jephthah. Jephthah, through no fault of his own, had found himself cast off from his brethren and had to make acquaintance with fellow cast-offs. This was the school of adversity that God had subjected him to in his love and mercy, not in his anger, not to throw Jephthah into a horrible situation just to see how he would respond to it. This was the school, the learning ground for Jephthah, to prepare him for his judgeship, to prepare him for the work ahead. As Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12, when Yahweh had responded to Paul, when he asked for his affliction to be removed, he said, "My strength is made perfect in weakness." Not in strength. God cannot deal with proud, haughty, strong flesh, if you like. Only those who have been weakened from the natural, haughty thinking of the flesh can God work. Even Jesus himself had to learn that the cross must come before the crown. We know of Jephthah's victory, so we won't read those verses. It was the irresistible progress of divine power. Nothing is mentioned about Ammon other than that they were destroyed and subdued before Israel. Or rather, they were subdued before Israel, which is another interesting type. Because even the great war, that our war with the beast at Christ's return, will not bring an end to the rebellious flesh. We read that the dragon is bound up, not destroyed. The end of to rebellious flesh is not until the end of the 1,000 years. A sad fact, but one that can't be denied. Leaving that behind them, we move on to Jephthah's vow. Some have suggested that it's idolatry. I think that's ludicrous. We've just seen that the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Jephthah. It didn't come upon people who were truly worthless. It came upon people who, as you said, conformed to God's ways and thinking. And also the fact that he's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 precludes the fact that this was idolatry, in other words, human sacrifice, just like the Aztecs used to participate in, and numerous tribes of the Middle East. Was he fully conscious of the potential implications? One writer certainly thinks that he was, and would have been more than conscious that he may have ended up offering his daughter. If that is so, then would God be pleased with such a vow? God never required human sacrifice under the law. We look at that in a little detail. And also, we feel verse 35 precludes that idea, because he said, "Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low." If he, in all sincerity, made a vow and expected his daughter to be a possibility, we feel that the response would have been different. So we believe, or I believe, that it was more of a rash vow, made in total sincerity, and one that God did accept, but which brought significant suffering to Jephthah. So did he fulfill his vow? Yes, of course he did. But the question is how? As one writer said, so many of the views expressed about this subject completely ignore the surrounding context, and often the very terms of the vow itself. Now, I found myself being completely unable to agree with the conclusions of this writer, but I do agree with that, saying that we need to recognize the context. I believe he looked at the context in the wrong light, but I'm not going to be dogmatic on this, really, but I'm going to present it dogmatically. If he followed his vow to offer a burnt offering, let us remember, brothers and sisters, it would have meant more than just slaying his daughter. It's not just a case of slitting her throat and throwing it on an altar. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 1. Perhaps we shouldn't allow this to cloud our judgment. He either did or he didn't. And but I do sort of struggle to think that it would have been an offering. If we look at Leviticus chapter 1 verse 3. If his offering be a burnt sacrifice, that was what it was going to be. That was what he vowed. And that's what it says he performed. If his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before Yahweh. And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement. And he shall kill the bullock before Yahweh, and the priest Aaron's son shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood round about upon the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Right. He has to flay the burnt offering. he has to cut it into his pieces. And the sons of the Aaron, the priest, shall put fire upon the altar and lay the wood in. Aaron's sons shall lay the parts, the head and the fat, in order upon the wood that is on the altar. But his inwards and his legs shall he wash in water. Do we really conceive of a human being offered in such a way? Maybe. And of course, we read that Abraham was commanded to offer up his son. And he was prepared to do it. But even then, Yahweh delivered him from the hand of the terrific ordeal. We also need to remember in that chapter of Leviticus that no provision was made for offering a human. It was a bullock. And there was certainly no provision for someone wishing to offer somebody else according to the law. You couldn't present yourself and offer yourself, much less somebody else. Therefore, this was an offering outside the law. It doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't do it, but it was an offering outside the law. And how you would have gone about doing this with the priest involvement, I would have no idea. Maybe somebody here does have an idea, and I'd be interested to hear it. But Deuteronomy 27 verse 26 says, "Cursed be he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them." And all the people shall say, "Amen." Deuteronomy 29 verse 9 says, "Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do." This was completely outside the law. And we know, of course, that Christ was outside the law, but it had to be outside of the law because Christ was sinless. The law could only condemn him in the method of his death and not in his disobedience to anything under the law. So Christ's sacrifice was outside the law. But other than that, all faithful servants of God kept the law. And of course, God did not require human sacrifice in anyone, bar in that one individual whose shed blood, and whose only shed blood, was efficacious for the taking away of sin. So what could be done then, if I'm going to sort of say that Jephthah didn't literally offer his daughter, then we have to come to some other conclusion. What could be done to fulfill his vow without breaking the law? Numbers chapter 6 goes through the law of the Nazarite. We won't turn to it because we don't have time. This may go some way to explaining what was done. But a burnt offering, or the Nazarite, was a setting apart, as we know. The burnt offering was a lot more than just setting apart. So what could he do? We don't read what he could do, really. But we do read in Romans chapter 12 that Paul beseeches you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that he present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is a reasonable service. In my eyes, her life became one of total separation. I don't believe that she was sacrificed. It may be a bit humanistic of me. I hope not. I believe it just was completely unfitting with God's requirements. So I don't believe that she was literally sacrificed, but I do believe that she led a life of total and utter separation. She was not to marry. She was not to engage in the same everyday way of life as her companions. From a natural point of view, she could be said to be living a living death. But in God's eyes, I believe she became a superlative type of the multitudinous Christ, who gives up all in this life in a living sacrifice. Not lining up, as Brother Thomas condemns, for martyrdom. That's not what's required, unless of course there's no other option. But giving up all that we have in this life, leaving all our ties, our ambitions, anything that relates to this life, and giving it to God. And I believe actually that a living sacrifice presents a more harmonious type in the context. Jephthah is a superb type of Christ, and I believe his daughter, who is unnamed, just like thousands of other God servants, is a superb type of the bride of Christ, born not in natural Israel, but in a time when Christ was in rejection by his people in a far country. We read of the 2 months that the daughter of Israel bewailed her virginity. It's a strange sort of way of putting it, but I believe in the light of the fact that she was a living sacrifice as opposed to a literal burnt sacrifice, that could represent the 2 millennia of the saints, when they, as the Apocalypse says, these are virgins having not been defiled with women. Perhaps those 2 months there represent the 2 millennia between Christ, the deliverer in his first advent and his return. That's just a suggestion. So let's move on then, extremely rapidly, to the lessons to be learned from Jephthah's daughter. I'm really not going to look at the types. There are some very interesting types, and I have some handouts, which I'm particularly glad that I did now, because unfortunately we're really not going to get time to look at those. So I'll give the handouts afterwards, and you can look at those in your own time then. So lessons to be learned from Jephthah's daughter then. Similar disposition to Isaac we see in Jephthah's daughter. Isaac completely submitted to the will of God. And bear in mind, he wasn't a little baby. He could have either run away or, I mean, his father was, I forget his age, maybe 100 at that time. He could have overcome his father, but no, just like Christ, he submitted to his father's will. He was oppressed, we read of Christ, and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, and he is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. Similar to Jephthah's daughter, submitted to the will of her father. She said, let this thing be done. My father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto Yahweh, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth. Wonderful example of the faithful bride of Christ. So the same humble faith that Jephthah had developed became imbibed in his daughter. The school of adversity that Jephthah had been subjected to put him in a good stead to pass this example on to his daughter. She recognized, like her ancestor Abraham, that we have here no continuing city. In other words, there's more to this life than just what we see around us. She sought one that is to come, a city that is to come. No links to this life. She was prepared to give up everything in this life for what was to come. And we have to ask the question, brothers and sisters, are we prepared to give up everything? Everything for Christ? We may, in all sincerity, long for the coming kingdom, but we can often be so guilty of wanting our kingdom now as well, almost like wanting the penny and the bun. We can say what we like and pray that we want the kingdom to come, but does our efforts, do our possessions, do our use of free time depict a flaw perhaps in our conviction? Each of us has to answer that question. I'll read from Elpis Israel, I'll try and praise it, regarding the child Moses. Although he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, this did not divert him from the faith. He had been indoctrinated. Boy, does the world hate that word as far as the truth is concerned. Those who bring up their children do indoctrinate them in the ways of Christ. That's the only way to do it. Moses, Brother Thomas says, had been indoctrinated into this in his tender years by his parents, for it is testified that by faith they hid him 3 months, not being afraid of the king's commandment, thus becoming heirs of the righteousness which is by the faith of the promises. This testimony to their faith, his parents, that is, shows that however delinquent others might be, that's an exhortation for us, the faith, the one faith of the gospel, dwelt in them. Because bear in mind, we're not talking about Moses' parents in the middle of Egypt, amongst the middle of cat-worshipping Egyptians. He was in the midst of Israel, in Goshen. And those in Goshen were delinquent, as the testimony tells us. They instilled this faith into Moses on the fleshy tables of whose heart it was so indelibly inscribed that not all the blandishments of the court of Egypt could efface it. The result of the parental instruction he had received was that by faith, when he came to years, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. For he had respect to the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Parallel to Jephthah and his daughter, who basically forsook everything. And obviously Jephthah's daughter could only do that because she had been brought up in that way. Some lessons for us then in Judges chapter 11. The things of the world, if engaged in, would become our scourge. They worshipped the gods of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites became their scourge. We can claim to love God as much as we like, but if at the judgment seat Christ sees that the world outside has a greater attraction for us than him, if he sees that the object of our desires was perhaps money, work, friends of the world, pleasures of the world, rather than the dogged study and perseverance, tireless perseverance in the things of the Spirit, which is irksome to the natural man, He will send us back into the world, which will have become, by that point, intolerably evil and violent. So if we make the world our friend, that's where we're going to find ourselves. And it's not going to be a pretty sight when he sends us back into the world. The flesh, Brother Grocott says, is your enemy, a very deceptive and hypocritical one, promising everything, delivering nothing. Don't mistake it for a friend, just like the gods of the Ammonites were mistaken for friends in the days of Israel here. There's no real joy and satisfaction except in spiritual things. To realize this in youth is a tremendous blessing. Most realize it too late or never at all. Thank God for the light and walk in it. That's the end of that quote. Trials, brethren and sisters, in the life of Jephthah is another thing that we can take as a lesson for ourselves, because it was the trials which prepared him for the great work he had to do. It wasn't in some gym building up his strength, working out to make sure that he could take on the greatest soldier in the Ammonite army. It wasn't in a military academy either. Nor was it in some philosophical school trying to understand the psyche of the Ammonites to try and beat them at their own game. It was in the school of adversity, the fiery trial that is necessary not to strengthen us in one sense, but to weaken us, to make us put all our trust in God, who is able to deliver us. This life, Brother Grocott says, is merely for education and training. We can never actually accomplish anything. Anything we do for God, he could do infinitely better and quicker himself. Such was the life of Jephthah that he found himself not with those who were high in the world, the high flyers, the top business people perhaps, but the cast-offs of the world. And this is the lot of all the faithful. The truth has never prospered at the high end of society. As Christ said, to the poor the gospel is preached. It was the visible spirit of God that influenced the battle between Jephthah and the Ammonites in Jephthah and Israel's favour. We also have a battle to fight, and while we don't have the visible hand of God, the same spirit, and that is exactly the same spirit, can decide the victory in our favour if we allow it to work in our lives. If we humble ourselves, but make ourselves courageous like Jephthah. In fact, it is only through the Spirit word that victory can be gained. Ephesians 6, which I would have turned to if we'd had time, presents the armour of the Spirit. Hebrews 4 says, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. We have been given all the equipment that we need, all the weapons to wage the warfare in our lives. They are only to be gained from God's word and nothing else. When we stand before the judge of all the earth, brethren and sisters, will Christ see victory in us? Or will he see someone who is being vanquished by the enemy of the flesh? I'll conclude with a quote from Sister Roberts. If no progress is made from the time the armour is put on to the time it is put off, the ability to cope with trial and difficulty is never developed. On the other hand, if we obey as far as we can see our way and seek to know the right way, this practice increases the power to do and to endure what is commanded. And what the young beginner would pronounce impossible is daily practiced by the steady student and brave soldier in the heavenly warfare. How wise then to seek daily that help which alone can enable the weak to be strong for the battle of life and will eventually lead to victory.